This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. John Carroll Whitener didn't have to go to war. In fact, he had an easy way out. He could have checked the box marked yes on the military form that asked if he had homosexual tendencies. That was 1964. The U.S. was ramping up its military involvement in Vietnam. But John Whitener's real battle was an internal one, a battle to reconcile his sexuality with his faith and his identity. What would his future look like if he was true to himself? John Whitener is the author of Don't Ask and I Will Tell, Finding Myself in Vietnam. And he joins me now from partner station Blue Ridge Public Radio to talk about that journey. John, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you for having me.
Your faith and religion did play a very important part in your upbringing. Tell us about the faith tradition you were raised in.
Well, it was a fundamentalist evangelical faith, very judgmental, and I was indoctrinated into this and bought into this from a very early age. I was 2 weeks old, as my mother recounts, when I first went to church. We went to church three times a week, twice on Sunday, Wednesday night prayer meeting. So it was an integral part of my own life. My social life revolved around it as well.
Did you find yourself embracing it? I mean, was it something, because, you know, for some kids, church is a real kind of a penance, to pardon the pun. But in other cases, it's something you really embrace, and it's really what you want and what you want to do. How was it for
you? We didn't know to question our parents. I had two brothers later on. I'm the oldest and a sister. It wasn't a question, do you want to go to church? It was just, that's what we did. And I didn't question that how I fit into that.
Well, tell us more about your family. What were your parents like and what they did?
Yes. So this is a rural area outside of Hickory. Everyone worked in either hosiery mills, textile mills, furniture factories. My dad worked in a hosiery mill. And when I was about two, he was drafted into World War II. He was a conscientious objector. He refused to be trained in rifle proficiency. He became a medic, which he served the duration of the war as a medic.
It's interesting to, and this is my prejudice maybe in my narrow-mindedness, but when I think about conservative Christian religions, I associate that with patriotism and not with conscientious objection.
Right.
That may be my failing, but I wonder if you ever asked him about that and why he objected, why he didn't want to pick up a rifle.
You know, this is one of the regrets of my life. As my dad has passed on a few years ago, I never had that discussion with him. You know, it was something about the sacredness of life. He even had trouble, I remember, killing when he went squirrel hunting and rabbit hunting. He went just to be with my uncle who had beagle hounds and to be out in the woods, but he wouldn't kill animals either.
You talked about growing up outside of Hickory, and of course, this was a time when there was a terrible polio outbreak in Hickory. What do you remember about that?
Well, I remember what my mother told me about that. I was a sickly child, she said, and my dad had been drafted and had left for some months, and I wasn't eating. So she took me to the doctor, and he said, well, he's either pining for his dad or he's too lazy to eat. So my mother chose to believe the pining part of the diagnosis.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
So my dad, once he went through basic and was settled in Fort Lewis, Washington, and found a small apartment, a converted garage, and sent for my mother and I. So my mother took a train from Hickory all the way to Tacoma, Washington. It was a five-day trip. She recounted to me that, you know, it was filled with soldiers, but they were always kindness shown to her as a single mother with a young child. They would give up their seats, and it was very courageous for my mother, I think, to leave on her own for the first time from Hickory and travel all the way there to join my dad.
And yours is a story that is really framed inside of this question of coming of age and coming to full knowledge of yourself and full expression of yourself as a gay man. And I wonder if you, when you began to know this as a young man.
Well, as I look back on my early childhood, I always had friends that were girls because I felt like I had more in common, or maybe I just wasn't macho. I didn't play sports. I knew I was different in some way, even before I knew how to put a name to those feelings.
You're even at that time, and I think that there's a story that you tell in the book about your first, quote, boyfriend in school.
Yes. Right? Yeah, so this was in the ninth grade. He was a boy, and he was a special friend, and we kissed in public on the school bus. You know, I don't know how we got by with this. I think it was some sort of theater on our mm-hmm. part. We did to provoke a girl that we didn't like who sat in front of us, and she went crazy when we did this. And we kissed more than once. Somehow I didn't get beaten up. And
What were you telling yourself at that moment? Again, okay, here's this act we can put on. It's going to get a reaction. People did things like this all the time in ninth grade, so we can get away with it. But were you telling yourself another story underneath the theater that you just created on that bus?
Well, again, I didn't put a name to all these feelings. I just knew that I was attracted to boys, but I wasn't going to act on it because that was not the accepted norm, and it was against my church teaching and expectations of my parents.
What prompted you to sign up for the military in 1964? You're 22 years old, a ramping up for Vietnam. It is becoming a lethal war for Americans, and you decide to sign up. Why?
Well, I never expected that signing up meant going to Vietnam. I was finishing up my last year in optometry school in Chicago, and I knew they were drafting young doctors. And my choice was to take a chance, borrow money, set up practice in Hickory, and then get drafted, or just volunteer. And I'd heard that if you volunteered, you had a good chance of getting the destination you wanted for your tour of duty. And I'd never traveled, and I wanted to go to Europe. And I thought, well, we have troops in Europe. I'm going to ask for Europe. And so I took my physical in the south side of Chicago in 64. And, I looked around. I think I was the only white guy in the taking the physical. It reminds me of all the draft was going on at that time. A lot of African-Americans were being drafted. Poor white boys that were not in college, did not have a deferment, were being drafted. But I did volunteer.
Well, let me stop you there, though. Were you aware of that at the time? Because certainly that has become one of the very important pieces in the story of Vietnam, who served and who didn't. But did it strike you at the time that this was that not everybody was serving in this war?
Not at that time. As I reflected back on it, of course, I mean, in years to come, I certainly recognized that it was part of my disillusionment of the government. And government policy that you could get out of service by having a deferment, being in school and then graduate school. You could stretch that out and hope that your lottery number didn't come to the mm-hmm. top, or maybe it was. I don't remember exactly how that worked, but
came late in the game. There wasn't a lottery early on, but again, there were ways if you had money that you could stay out and keep it that way for a while. But there's a question now on this questionnaire that you're having to fill out as you sign up. Tell us about it.
So it's a medical physical, and part of it's asking questions similar to when you go to a doctor. When we go to doctors today, do you have diabetes? Do you have headaches? Well, one of the questions was, do you have homosexual tendencies? Wow. I had no idea that would be on the form. And, you know, I had not admitted to myself that I was gay. And I could have checked. No, I could have lied. There were consequences. I remember a story. You know, I was taught not to lie, as many of us are. And my Granny Whitener taught a Sunday school class, and she uses an object lesson about lying one time. She had me sit in a chair in front of the class and my arms down by my side, and she put a string around my shoulders and around my arms. She said, "Break loose," and I broke loose. And then she put two strings and I broke loose. Then she put multiple strings, and she said, "Break loose," and I couldn't break loose. And she said, this is like the web of lies. You know, the more lies you tell, you're going to be caught. You can't break loose from this. So I was taught not to lie. But but if I said yes on the form, I would be classified 4F, which meant unsuitable for military service. And that had many consequences for future employment, for, you know, my family and others to know that. So I lied.
So you lied.
I checked. No.
You said no, and yeah. And you got in. And again, I'm wondering about this moment too. You obviously you realize at this moment you had a very strong sense of who you were and what your identity was. Had you told yourself that prior to this, or was this the moment when you had to come to terms with it?
Well, you know, I lied to myself. I dated girls. I dated girls in a girl in high school and girls in college. So I was trying to fit in. I was trying to overcome my homosexual feelings because I wanted to get married. I wanted to fit into the norm. I wanted to get married to a woman, have children, all of that sort of thing I bought into. And yet, because it was the norm of society and also because of my religious fundamentalist background, that it was a sin to have thoughts about men, same-sex sex, and certainly not to act on it, but even to have thoughts about it.
So you check,
I just pushed it away.
Pushed it away. You check no, and you get in, and you're hoping to go to Europe. The Army has different ideas for you. They send you to Vietnam on a ship. You went over on a boat, huh?
Yeah. So I was stateside for about a year, seeing lots of patients who were being shipped out, never thinking it would be me. I thought I would serve out my time in states. But I did get orders to a classified area overseas, and that's what it said, and I knew what that meant. We formed our unit in Fort Lewis, Washington. Strangely enough, it was exactly 20 years since my father had been there during World War II. So, yeah, we put our unit together. We ordered equipment. And we flew from there to Oakland, where we boarded the ship. Now, there were over 2 million soldiers who eventually served in Vietnam, and only about 10% of them had the pleasure of a cruise, a 20-day cruise.
What was that like?
Well, now, you know, as a privileged officer, I look back on this, it was okay. We had we were served with tablecloths and round tables of six. We had choice of entrees. While the enlisted, unfortunately, you know, lived in the bowels of the ship and had served on cafeteria style metal trays. So, yeah, and it was boring. 3 weeks with nothing to do. There was no internet, no TV. Occasional radio could pick up some radio signals. But so most people played cards, poker, bridge, gin. But, you know, playing cards was a sin. That was one of the don'ts of my religion. No playing cards, no dancing, etc. So I went to Bible study every day. I had time to start my diary, my diary of 66, 67.
What was happening with the diary, and were you honest in your journal?
No, I was very guarded. I always thought, what happens if I die, if I'm killed during this time, and, you know, someone reads this. So I was very guarded in terms of my sexual feelings for anyone or attraction. Yeah, I was very guarded in that, but I certainly didn't forget that part of my journey.
Yeah, you had an optometry practice. You ended up in a place called Phan Rang, supporting the 101st Airborne. Is that right?
Right.
Tell us more about that.
It was their base camp. It was about 5 miles from the South China Sea, south of Cameron Bay, which was a big port area. The Corps of Engineers came in and scraped out all vegetation. It was nothing there but red dust, which blew all the time. And, you know, they put our tents on that.
What were you doing there?
Well, so for the first couple months, I did nothing. Well, for the first month, I did nothing because my equipment never arrived. The equipment I packed in Fort Lewis, Washington, either arrived in Vietnam and was stolen on the docks, or it never arrived. It was lost. So I ate 3 meals a day and got a suntan and read a lot of books from the library. But yeah, it was boring. So I decided I needed to do something, and the STD clinic was our busiest clinic every day. After all, there was it was called the Strip, right outside the gates, where there was prostitution, and so a lot of the a lot of the troops contracted venereal disease, and so I decided to work there. I drew blood, I tested for gonorrhea, etc.
Veterans often talk about the camaraderie of war, I mean, even in situations like that. But you wrote that you found that spending so much time with people, especially if you're closeted, if you're not being honest with yourself, you don't really become close friends, or at least that was the case for you, right?
It was the case. And part of that was being guarded, you know, in what I said and did. But, you know, you have these people thrown together. We had 5 officers and 17 enlisted in our dispensary. You're thrown together from all over the country. And you live together, you work together, you eat together 24/7. But that doesn't make you friends necessarily. And I shared a tent with a dentist for a year. We never had real talks about what was important to us. Every night, he would go to his clinic and write a letter to his wife and get drunk every night. So sometimes he would pass out there. Sometimes he would then go to the officers' club and drink more. But I never had a conversation about why are you doing this, and certainly not sharing my feelings about my sexual feelings, which, of course, I didn't act on in that setting, but, you know, that I had those feelings. So,
well, you may not get close personally or develop that kind of relationship, but it is the kind of proximity that allows people to observe your behavior very closely. Did you have a sense that anyone suspected you of being gay?
Well, I was always on guard. Part of our social life there was going to the officers' club, which was in two tents, and everyone drank. I don't remember anyone else not drinking except me. And of course, drinking was one of the rules of my religion I observed. And so I was always afraid I would slip and say something, or I was always on guard. And I'm sure that kept me from being close to anyone.
I'm talking with John Carroll Whitener, a retired Army colonel and the author of Don't Ask and I Will Tell, Finding Myself in Vietnam. And we will continue our conversation on the state of things in just a moment. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, and I'm talking to John Carroll Whitener, who deployed to Vietnam in his 20s, where he didn't exactly hide the fact that he was gay, but then again, he hadn't quite accepted it himself. His deployment continued, and he started questioning the politics of all of it, and he took a deeper look at himself, too. John Whitener is the author of Don't Ask and I Will Tell, Finding Myself in Vietnam, and he's with us from partner station Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. You know, John, it's interesting to think about this because your religion, a fundamentalist Christian, you say you didn't play cards, you didn't drink. I mean, that made you an outsider, and I'm guessing it gave you a little bit of cover. In other words, if people thought you were different, it might be that, huh?
Yes, it could be. I look back on that and I still wonder how I got by with not being questioned or called out. In writing the book, I did call up one person that I'm still in touch with from my unit, and I said, you know, didn't you guys talk about me maybe being gay or, you know, whatever? And he said, well, you know, I thought you were a little effeminate, a little light in the loafers, which I had never even heard that term before. I wore combat boots every day, light in the loafers.
That filled him out pretty well.
Yeah. So, and I also, I dated a Vietnamese girl who worked in the PX next door to our clinic. So, you know, again, trying to blend in, trying to conform.
There's another episode that you write about in the book, another soldier who you thought might have been gay at Phan Rang, and a conversation that you never had with him. Tell us about that.
Yes, Michael. So he worked for another doctor for a while, but he asked if he could start working with me. And so maybe there was, you know, this, maybe he sensed I was gay as well. He was going through a divorce himself back home, but the guys, there were rumors from the enlisted that he was gay, and they were laughing about it and so forth. So one evening he went out drinking with an Air Force buddy, and somewhere along the way coming back to the base camp, they sat down and maybe passed out, whatever. There was a sexual advance apparently from Michael, and the guy picked up a rock and bashed his face in. So Michael came back to the clinic requiring stitches. Well, the other guy required some stitches too. And, you know, how did this happen? Well, the other guy told, and that started a CID Army investigation, which could lead to his dishonorable discharge for homosexual activities. So I look back on that regretfully because I never offered any consolation or any words to Michael in his time of need.
Did you feel
because I felt it would reflect upon myself and the fact that I was gay.
So you were conscious of that. I mean, did you feel the conflict in that moment or only afterward?
Oh, that's hard to say. I certainly afterwards.
Yeah.
I was too caught up in the moment to try to do anything about it, I suppose.
I mean, that's it. It sort of illustrates the depth to which you have internalized this story about normalization if you don't even feel the pain of that until afterward when you finally have come out. I mean, it's a sort of an interesting snapshot if you think about your emotions in that time.
Yes, and it was also part of compartmentalizing my life. You know, I just put that away in a compartment and didn't deal with it in an open way.
You're also having some serious thoughts about U.S. involvement in Vietnam after your stay there, or during your stay, right?
Yes. Well, I heard stories from the 101st Airborne Troops who were out in the rice paddies and the jungles, and they came back and talked about, you know, clearing an area of VC and North Vietnamese troops, and then they'd go back a week or two later, and they were back again. I mean, it was a futile war. We were fighting a conventional war with guerrillas, and a civil war that I realized we should never have been involved with.
You get back and you're stationed at Fort Bragg next. Talk about that experience, because that becomes a real pivotal moment in your life.
It certainly does. So it was an easy drive back on weekends to Hickory to visit my parents from Fort Bragg. And we always went to church on Sunday, and I met the pastor, and who was a very charismatic person. I liked him. And after a few weeks, he started calling me in my apartment in Fort Bragg. And he told me eventually, he said, "I love you." I went, "Oh my gosh." I couldn't handle that. So here was my greatest fantasy and my worst fear. A man loved me, but it was the wrong man. Mm-hmm. Not only my parents' pastor, but he was friends. They socialized together. One of my brothers played, you know, grew up with one of his sons. He had three children. So, wow, this was a pivotal moment, because I realized if a man of God could have these feelings and could love someone of the same sex, so could I.
So in a way, this opened you up to yourself, did it?
Absolutely. It really was the change.
What was your sense of him at this time? Obviously, you couldn't pursue this relationship given all the connections with your family. At least you felt that at the time. But what was your sense of this pastor, this man? Did you see him as someone who was going through the same kind of struggle as you? Were you disappointed that a man of the cloth would be what would appear to be hypocritical in preaching one thing? How were you feeling about him?
Yeah, the hypocritical part. You know, and it was also my separation from organized religion and at that time. You know, yes, it was hypocritical, and I'd been struggling with all these feelings and trying to reconcile my sexuality with God, and this was like, no, not going to bother with this anymore. Not going to deal with church and religion at this point in my time in life.
Now, you're still in the military at this point, right?
Yes. So I was stationed at Fort Bragg about a year, and I got orders finally for Europe that I'd wanted from the beginning. And it was in Germany in my first year that I met Karl Heinz, who was the first long-term boyfriend, someone I fell in love with.
You felt comfortable enough at that point to have an actual relationship and a sustained relationship with a man.
Well, I put on my uniform every day. This was a time when people were growing their hair long. I used Dippity Doo product.
That, by the way, that to me is the biggest revelation in the book. I don't know how you found the courage to put that in your book, but you did.
So I pasted my hair down to look regulation-like. And I wore my uniform. I did my job all day. And in the evening, I combed the dippity-doo out and put on civilian clothes and had another life. And then on weekends as well. So, yeah, it was Karl Heinz and I dated for a year. We went on trips together. Went to Paris together.
Well, the relationship did end, and that's an important part of the story as well. Tell us that.
Yes. So from childhood, he had gone back in the summers to his grandmother's house near Prague. And so he went back again during the year for a week or so while I was dating him. He came back and said, I've decided to marry my childhood sweetheart, Regina. Wow. So I wasn't ready for that. But with time, I accepted that because on some level, I wanted this for myself still on some level, this ingrained sense that you're supposed to get married, have kids, and all that. So I was, on some level, I was happy for him. And in fact, he asked me to be best man for his wedding. I accepted. I drove to Prague, where all the family gathered at his grandmother's house out in the country. And
Go ahead, finish that story.
Well, yeah, so there was a lot of people in this small house, and, you know, so they knew Karl Heinz was my friend, so they put us in the same room at night. So we slept together the last night before his marriage, and I remember saying to him clearly, do you think this is the right thing? Are you doing the right thing? And he said, I don't know, but I'm going to. So the next day, we went to the town hall in Prague. It's beautiful square if you've been there to Prague, you know. Mm. And the town hall, and went to sign the marriage license. I was his best man, and my name is on that document still today, I guess, in the town hall.
Trying to imagine all that's going through your mind, because on the one hand, you envied him because he was going to actually materialize the fantasy that you had had to normalize your life and be accepted, marry a girl, and get married. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you had to empathize to some degree, did you, to some degree with the conflict that he had internalized, the lie about himself, and couldn't bear the truth, and so had to sort of live the fictional life. That also had to be going through your mind.
Yeah, and You know, it's we've remained friends all these years. When I went back to visit him 7 years after this occurred, the marriage occurred, he now had a five-year-old son named Marcus John. He had given Marcus my name as his middle name. He and Regina were very happy. And in fact, I asked him, we went out that afternoon together, and I said, you know, are you happy? And he says, yes, I am. So I was happy for him. Unfortunately, a year later, they were divorced. But as I said, we've remained friends with both of them all these years.
You left the military in 1973, went to study public health at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and ended up becoming a gay rights advocate and educator. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, so getting out of the military was the right thing. I needed to grow my hair long. I needed a long-term boyfriend. I needed a gay-friendly town to live in. So I was drawn to Chapel Hill. It was at Chapel Hill that I met other gay men, and we started talking about forming an association with the university there. And that's when I became a master's student in public health at the school. So I was one of the founding members of the Carolina Gay Association, which later changed its name to be more inclusive. But we sponsored dances on campus, which were open to all student, gay or straight, which was sort of revolutionary, I guess, at that time. And we formed a speakers bureau where we went to various classes that invited us to talk about being gay, answering questions. We were exotic and maligned people, as I like to say, as I recall.
Well, you had a moment when, because you still haven't really come out to your family yet, had you?
Right. So at that time, I realized I needed to come out to my family. So I came out to my parents, which handled this much better than I expected and said they still loved me, didn't understand, but still loved me. And then because I was speaking at campuses, including where my brother, my youngest brother, was studying, I felt like I needed to tell him, since he might see me or hear that I was on campus. And he handled it very well. But my parents asked me not to share this with my family. They couldn't handle someone knowing. So I only, for a number of years, only told my parents and my one brother.
What about your faith? How did you reconcile things with that? Or did you?
Well, during this time, I still just put those thoughts in the back of my mind and didn't deal with it. I did not go back to the church of my childhood, and I tried other churches and nothing seemed to fit, and I'd go a while and then stop. And my faith was on hold for a number of years after that. It wasn't, in fact, until I was here in Asheville, and I tried a number of churches in Asheville, and then I found the United Church of Christ, First Congregational United Church of Christ, 15 years ago. And I immediately, it's just hard to describe, felt this sense of love and connection. And I wanted to be a part of this community. A year later, I was asked to teach in Sunday school children. They knew I was openly gay. This was not an issue. This was so affirming to me and my faith that I could be gay. I could be acceptable to God, to my church.
You didn't go through your journals. We talked about those that you began on that ship over to Vietnam, and you didn't really look at them until you'd retired. What was it like for you to read them again? Did you recognize the young man who had been making those entries?
Well, it was difficult. That's why I didn't read them all those years until 5 years ago when I retired. I'm so grateful that I survived that period of my life. I'm sad for those who didn't. It was a different time. It was a time when people didn't discuss sexuality. There were no TV shows with gay characters, no role models, no movies, a few novels, but there were always sad characters who who frequently killed themselves because they were gay. So I'm so grateful that our society in general has progressed. I never thought I'd live today to, you know, the military of all parts of society, the military accepting gay people. And one of my proud moments is taking my husband to the local National Guard to get his military ID card made. He was now an official spouse with those benefits of the military, including retirement benefits if I die before him. I never thought I would live to see that day, and I'm so grateful that we have made those changes.
John Carroll Whitener, a retired Army colonel, the author of the new book, Don't Ask and I Will Tell, Finding Myself in Vietnam. John, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Frank. Appreciate it.
John joined us from partner station Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville, and you can find out more about their show at our website, stateofthings.org. Our show is produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.